beaten path.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be standing here. I don't know if you might all might want to get to my left a little bit to be able to see. I don't know. See the screen well enough. Those of you with the Olivet t-shirts on need to make sure you see the big tall guy at Mid-America and shine that sweatshirt in front of him. That'll be good. His name's Roger. You can tell him I said to say hi.
I've applied to Tribeca, to Olivet, to MNU, all those.
So you have decisions to make.
So like I've pretty much decided on MNU.
Got
a full ride.
Good. Good. Starting this fall?
Starting this fall.
Cool. Very nice.
I move in August 3rd. Mm-hmm. And it starts August 16th.
Very nice. And both my parents were at Olivet, and two nephews and a niece, and a lot of family members that went through Olivet with very good experiences. The new president there, Greg Chenoweth, is on the board of directors of the foundation. So, he's a good guy.
Yeah, I'm going for a major in pastoral ministries and then a minor in business.
Sweet. I was a ministry major and an accounting minor.
Oh, really?
And I was actually an accounting tutor. And people said, why do you take all the accounting classes? So I'm trying to bring my grades up in religion. Now I have accountants, one a CPA, that actually report to me. So didn't realize how essential that would be in life. I remember like two words from all those accounting classes, and it really helps.
I was gonna do a double major, a major in pastoral ministries, major minor business, and then a minor in I don't know if it was accounting or transformational leadership. One of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So the business aspect of it is really important because most ministerial training doesn't include a lot of it. Even in seminary, just like a little 1-hour class that says this is how you operate the church. And then especially coming straight out of school into First Church, unless you take a route to be an associate of some kind at a larger church, if you become I was a senior pastor at 25 straight out of seminary. And at that point, you had everything put in your lap. The entire business of the church. It was all right there with practically zero training for anything like that. So,
yeah. I also want to open up my own business. Mm-hmm. So,
good.
It goes
wonderful. It does, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I think those that blend of education is a really wise path.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me like any of the professional schools have very little emphasis. Finances,
yeah.
Economics.
Yeah, that's true.
As a physician, I
don't know if I'll be blocking you on this side or not, or if you need to move over, you can if you can't see. That's true. So, coming out of seminary, I went to a church that had a brand new facility, a brand new parsonage, and a brand new debt.
Right.
And so. So it took nearly half of the entire offering just to cover the debt. And I was not smart enough to understand what that's like or anything. So I arrive at the church and the electricity is ready to be shut off and the bank is asking for 5 mortgage payments behind. And that's when I realized, wow, I may have asked more questions before I decided to come here. But the Lord put me there and it was what we're supposed to do. We got it all caught up and did the right thing, but still it would have been helpful to have known a little more about that before I walked in. The other thing that does is it gives you the reputation as being the person who can fix a debt mess. That's not necessarily what you want your reputation to be as a pastor, but that did sort of happen. So, well, according to that clock up there, it's time, and I'm going to bring my phone up here, not so that I can check messages occasionally, but so that I can see it is, in fact, 11:17. And we're ready to go. So thanks for coming, everybody. I always joke about the number of chairs in the room because often I'm teaching a class on church finance, and the next room over will be, Dan Boone teaching on sexual ethics or something, you know, and everybody will be standing room only, and I'll say, put me by that room because we're going to have extra chairs and they're going to need extra chairs. So I am glad that you've decided to come here today and be involved in this class. This is the class called, what's it called?
Finding Resources.
Finding Resources, yeah, make sure I'm on the right one. Finding Resources for Ministry. And so we're going to talk about those resources and a little bit about how the foundation can help with some of those resources. So the Church of the Nazarene Foundation, we're 19 years old, and we have distributed about $115 million in that 19 years into ministry that comes through various unusual gifts. These are typically not gifts that fall on the offering plate. It's not gifts that you get when it goes by. It's the unusual gifts that come through estates or gifts of real estate, gifts of businesses, gift annuities, charitable trusts, and all kind of cool things that we're talking about here today. And it is a real blessing to be involved in those things. So I'll start off with a fun story. Sometimes I save the fun stories for the end, but we're just going to start off with one. And this is from February of this month. So we had a person that we met about 15 years ago that we helped with their will. We worked with their attorney to make sure that that some of their gift went, some of their assets at death went charitable. We don't always know how much money a person has, but we find that out after they pass away. In this case, the individual was unfortunately. Can you all hear me? I'm not picking the microphone up. Is it good? We're all right? Okay, good. So everybody in here can hear me, right? I mean, I can pull it up here if you think we really need to, but that might be a little overkill at this point. Okay, good. I'm just as happy not holding it. So we worked with this individual, worked with their attorney, made sure that part of their estate was going to go into what we'll discover later as a donor-advised fund, and his family was going to say, whatever I leave charitable, you can direct it to this ministry, that ministry, whatever. And so 15 years go by, and we hear from an attorney, the man was unfortunately killed a little early in life at 64 years of age, no children, and half of his estate was to go to the foundation, Church of the Nazarene Foundation. So half of his estate's really cool. In this case, it was a very southern lawyer that called me, and she was talking really fast, and she's like, and when the check comes, you got a bit, you know, like all this information. And I said, I'm sorry, who are you, and what are we talking about? Oh, yeah, and she goes through all this kind of stuff, and I'm writing notes and scribbling it down, and after I scribble it down, she said, you're going to get 5% of the state for 10 years. Okay, that's right, 5% and 10 years. And then she either said, the estate is approximately $2 million, and so 5% is $90,000. Or she said, 5% of the estate is $2,090,000. And I couldn't tell from my notes which one was which. So I called the office and I said, yeah, we're going to be getting a check in the mail. And actually, it took a little while to go through probate, so we're going to get the first two checks. So I said, we're going to get an envelope, and it's either going to have two checks for $90,000, or it's going to have two checks for $2,090,000 each. Pay attention to the envelope. Give me a call when it comes in, you know. So it came in, and it was actually $2,090,000 each check. So we got $4,180,000 on the first round, and it'll come up to close to $20 million by the time it's all done. So I'm working with a family. None of them go to the Church of Nazarene anymore, but they still love the church. And so they said, well, we got to find something to do with this $4 million. His church was the church that he attended. He loved that church and had some debt. Let's pay their debt off. And I could tell on the phone they were saying, like, how would we know what their debt is? I said, I'll be happy to do the legwork. I'll call the pastor and talk about it. So I called the pastor and left a message, and he never called me back. So I called the pastor again and left a message, and he still didn't call me back. I called him another day and said, got him on the phone, and he said, you know, I'm out taking a walk right now, and I need to find a place to go to the restroom or something. Can you call me back later? And I said, yeah, I can call you back later. So I called him back later, and I said, really, the only thing I need to know is how much. He later told me he thought I was a telemarketer from Nazarene headquarters. So that's what he thought. So I said, no, not a telemarketer from Nazarene headquarters, but I just want you to know that that a member of your congregation that passed away a few years ago has left some money, and we're going to pay off your church's debt. We just need to know the amount. The entire tone of the conversation changed. And I do believe that what was happening on the other end of the phone was a visitation of the Holy Spirit, because there was a lot of things happening out there. So they got us the number, and it came back, and it was $320,000 was in debt. They had no idea how much money the man had left. We didn't know until it came in. And so so we started getting it together. I go back to the family and said, it's $320,000. They said, that's fine. We figured it'd be more than that. They probably have some maintenance needs. Let's just go ahead and make it $700,000. So I called the pastor back up, answered on the first call. First ring. He's right there. He answered. And so I talked to him, and I said, well, I got some more good news for you. And he's on the other end. He goes, is this what you do for a living? You just call people up and tell them that you're sending them money? I said, well, my job's a little more complicated than that, but that's part of it. Yeah, this is a fun thing to do. We get to do this sometimes. And so we presented a big check at his church and so forth, paid off the debt and everything. And it was really a blessing to the congregation, because they had, it's not a big church by any means, but it's a pretty active church and a good church, and they had just stepped into a chunk of ministry that was a stretch for them and required a lot of faith to move into this new thing that they felt like God was supposed to be making them do. And the fact that their mortgage payment was wiped out was a major blessing right on top of that whole thing. So I can't promise you that's going to happen, but I can tell you we've given $115 million away in the last 19 years, and most of that in the most recent years as the foundation was getting off the ground. It was smaller, you know. So we send about $10 million out to ministry every year at this point, and that's the function. Throughout this, we believe that our mission here is to help people be really good stewards of the stuff that they have, recognizing that God owns everything. That's where it has to start. God owns everything. And that we're here to be blessings for God's glory. So everything God puts in our hands as people is for His glory. This is what we're supposed to do. If He gives us some money, we're supposed to glorify Him with it. If He gives us some kids, we're supposed to glorify Him. And to recognize that most everything that there is comes to us from God, but it's not really ours. If we own a house, it's not really, it's God's. It's going to belong to somebody else. We're all going to go to heaven someday, and somebody else is going to be pounding nails in our walls and everything else that's happening out here. So that's the basis of stewardship that we approach life with, and most definitely not a basis where we would say that we ask for money because the church needs money, because we fully believe that God's got all the resources He needs. God doesn't need our money. The whole concept of stewardship is that people need to give. And we believe that churches that did a great job of teaching stewardship throughout their history survived the pandemic much better, because they weren't saying, we need money because we have to operate. They were saying, the reflection of God's love on us is giving and giving back to Him. So I actually did all that without showing you the slide that says those things, that we are caretaker, guardian, and manager. But manager of what? Well, if you look at the people around the Missouri district, you'll find all sorts of economies, up the economy scale, down the economy scale. But what you will find is that even the poorest people in this district are wealthy by world standards. In fact, they tell us that if we slept under a roof last night, and got here in a car, and you have enough food in your home that you're not worried about starving to death between now and next Saturday, you could survive with a week, that you're wealthier than most people that have ever lived in history. And today, wealthier than a lot of people around the world because you have those things. So the question has to be, what are we going to do with these things? I missed it, Canton, Ohio. I did this one a couple weeks ago in Canton, Ohio. Missed that. All right. So what kind of things can we help people be good stewards of, and how do we work with them to accomplish those things? Well, the basics are a will or a trust. Is there anybody in here who would like to, while I get you our key brochure, explain to me the difference between a will and a trust? Any attorneys in here?
A will is a direction how your assets are disposed of when you pass. A trust is a living entity that owns the properties that you have.
Uh-huh.
It's stewarded by trustees.
Very good. So the will is a set of instructions that says, at the end of my life, do these things with my stuff. And the trust can go, owns the assets. I'll walk these down. But also can do things both before and after you pass away. How did you know those things? Just general knowledge?
My parents passed in the last
3 years. Oh, yes. Here, one more.
The privilege of going through a will and a trust.
So every revocable trust has a will. It's called a pour-over will. And so you had to, did you have to probate that trust or was that, or that will or?
I did not, but I did have to probate my mother's estate because there were things that fell outside of the trust.
Yeah.
And were exceeded the non-probate.
So so that's the concept behind the pour-over will. Essentially, you make a trust, put your assets in the trust, and you make a will that says, if I forgot to put anything in my trust, I will it to my trust.
Yep.
So congratulations on going through that. Did you get through that in about, what, 3 or 4 weeks?
No. The bulk of it happened within the first year.
Uh-huh.
However, there was a annuity we didn't find out about. Until last year, a year later, then I had to, fortunately, I had already petitioned the court for, to be the, in Arizona they call it something else, the executor, it's personal representative.
Personal representative, yeah. Most states either use executor or personal representatives with wills, trustee with trust.
Right.
Yeah.
My sister and I were co-trustees on the trust, but she gave me control to manage that trust.
Good.
And so that took some of the complication out.
Yeah.
And then we discussed that, and I also became the personal representative for my mother's estate.
Right.
Which hopefully will get closed at the end of this month.
Yeah, so if you get through probate in 9 months, you went speedy, you know, in all likelihood a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years, we got them really old. We had one that attorney called this week and told us that the family, the deceased, several years ago, their estate was closed, but nobody knew they had this 120 acres, and so now the Church of the Nazarene Foundation owns 1% of that real estate along with 25 other living heirs and 8 deceased heirs. So I told the attorney, congratulations. Untying all this one, that's going to be a big one. So those kind of things can happen, but it emphasizes the reason I say you don't do all the preparations for the end of your life for yourself. You do this for the people you leave behind because you have the opportunity to leave them with a better situation than they would if you die intestate. So the reason I'm talking about this is because in this world of other giving, the estate gifts that come in typically run 5 to 10 times the amount of a person's annual giving. So if somebody decides to leave your church in their will or in their trust, the size of that gift is in all likelihood going to be north of 5 times what their annual giving is. So if somebody's given $10,000, you can predict that they're probably going to do an estate that's going to be $50,000 to $100,000, and sometimes a whole lot more. You just never know. But these are gifts that happen because churches make them available, give them the opportunity for that to happen. So the difference between churches that receive estate gifts and churches that don't receive estate gifts is that the churches that receive them have told their people, hey, would you like to give to this? When we're working with people and they say, well, I did my will, you know, but I decided to give some to hospice and some to the state university and all these things, you know. Was, you know, you lived your life in the Church of the Nazarene. This has been the most important thing. Why did you choose some other organization and not the Church of the Nazarene? They say, well, the Cancer Society asked if they could be in our will, and my local church didn't ask. So the thing we do is we say, let's ask for this. And when we do have that opportunity to distribute some of the assets to a local church, very often the pastor says, the timing is perfect because you know, resources are here. Our vision is farther than our resources. And this is exactly what we need to bring the resources up to the vision. It's an unhealthy situation when resources are beyond your vision. That's just a lack of vision. Because every growing, thriving ministry is pulling the resources with them. They're ahead of their resources. And this is just a way to do it. You ought to just say to your church, hey, leave us in your will. You know, think about this, doing something. So about 40% of Americans get it right. Nearly 60% of Americans procrastinate getting a will done or trust, or they do it wrong some way that it's not going to actually go through the court system when they go to heaven. And you have the opportunity right now to do things that you don't have the opportunity to do once you're in the grave. And God has called me to talk about money and death. Isn't that the most exciting thing in the world? So we got to talk about it and make it fun here. But you have assets and you have children, and if you go to heaven and your spouse goes to heaven without a will, then a probate court judge is going to decide who raises your children. Probate court judge is going to decide what happens to your money. You have the opportunity now to say, I want these people to raise my children, and it doesn't have to be the same person that handles the money. And you get to have some direction over the money. Do you want life insurance money to get your children to 18 and boot them out the door? Or would you like to save some for college? Or, you know, how do you want this to happen? Sometimes people that are raising somebody else's children won't touch the money and say, no, that's all theirs when they're 25. Well, it may be actually better for your children to have some of those resources before that time. And so you get to be the one that decides that. So on this will and trust, a will works for most people. A lot of people have wills. A will is a set of instructions that at the moment you die, it says, do these things with these things. All this stuff, do this with it. It's going to go to a probate court judge. In most cases, if it's tiny, perhaps not. But most people die with more than they think they have. Most people have a house, some retirement, and some savings. Maybe a car and some other things. Some people have a lot more. Some people have a lot less. If you genuinely die with nothing, almost nobody does that. But if you do, it's because you were either in debt, which is less than nothing, or you had medical cost or long-term care costs that consumed all of your resources. So those are the things that that tend to cause people to die with nothing. If you genuinely die with nothing, then there's not a lot left for the will or the trust to do other than perhaps give custody to children. But most people die with something. And so that's the people we're talking about here right now. That will is that set of instructions for that moment, do these things under the guidance of a probate court judge. The trust is something different, and by trust is an umbrella term. We're going to talk about revocable trust here at this point. Revocable means you can undo this thing, where you go to an attorney, they write a trust, and you put your assets in the trust. And a trust, that term, means I have somebody that I really am confident will do this right. So, for example, if I'm in the airport and I have my suitcase beside me and my wife's sitting there, I might say to my wife, would you watch my suitcase for a moment? I need to step into the restroom. I have just created a trust. I have an asset that I can't care for a period of time, and I'm transferring the care of that asset to somebody that I trust. I would not look at a stranger and say, would you watch my suitcase while I step in the restroom? I would only do that with my wife because I trust her. And so you're saying, when you create a trust, you're saying to the probate court judge, we don't need you. We got this. Got this taken care of. I have a person that I believe that I can trust to do this work from beginning to end without any concerns. That's the trust. It saves the probate court costs at the end. However, the trust costs more at the beginning. But staying out of probate costs is pretty significant. Timing-wise, one of the things that makes a real difference is if your house or your car is in the trust name and you have a trustee, death certificate comes within a week, you can start selling things. With a probate court judge, you're looking at probably a few months to get to the point where you could sell a car or sell a house or anything. So it speeds things up, makes it a lot easier out there in the end. But a will is right for most people and okay. Why do people procrastinate this thing? I don't know. But everybody needs to move a little farther along in this. If you were to just look at the whole history of the world and say, here's the United States of America, and they are more blessed by God than any group of people has ever been. They got more stuff than anybody can think of. Certainly those people would do something to make sure that everything is inherited the way they wanted it to. What you go do is you go back to the Old Testament and find out that people were very concerned about inheritance in their life. What's going to happen to their stuff, lineage? The Bible even tells us that a righteous man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Not just his children, but his children's children. So we have the opportunity to do this right. You're probably going to need a will or trust, durable power of attorney, which lets somebody sign your named documents in case you cannot, healthcare power of attorney, which lets them sign medical forms if you cannot, and a healthcare directive, which our long-term care nurse back here would say is pretty important.
All those are
the right thing to do.
Healthcare power of attorney, the financial power of attorney.
Yeah. If you,
power of attorney, because you have to remember that if they're not deemed incompetent by two physicians and they are still out of their mind, they can still sign it.
Mm-hmm. So you're probably going to run into these, like every time you go to an emergency room, get an x-ray, you're going to answer this question over and over and over. And those are the important set of documents right there. Okay. If you don't have a will, the little card that I gave you has a QR code on it. And it has a website on it. You can go to that. Anybody in America can go to NazareneFoundation.org/wills and create a will. Works a little bit like TurboTax. You're answering questions, saying, this is my name, this is what I have, this is what I want to do. And it will produce a will based on the law of the state that you're in. Okay, and then you follow the instructions that it gives you to get that notarized, signed, to however many witnesses are necessary in whatever state you're doing this from. And I encourage you, if you are one of the 60% of America that has procrastinated and has not got it done, that you do that today, tomorrow, before this weekend is over, that you say, I'm just going to sit down, I'm just going to do this thing. Our first recommendation is that you go to an attorney, but since half of America hasn't done that, we're making this available. And it works a little bit on the H&R Block concept. H&R Block says you should come to us and get your taxes done and pay us. But here's some free software if you want to do it yourself. So they know that a lot of people are going to get this started and say, yeah, maybe I do need a lawyer. If your life's not too complicated, this is probably going to be okay, and it's certainly better than nothing. But if you get into it and realize this is a little over my head, that's when we encourage you to make sure that you get a will done. Actually, you have an attorney on this advisory board here. Does anybody remember the attorney's name? He's over on the Illinois side a little.
Spiker.
Yeah, Spiker, that's right. He's, is he on the Illinois?
No, he's on
the Missouri. He's in Illinois. I thought maybe he lived on the across the river there a little bit. Yeah, so you can go to him and just say, hey, I need this, and they'll do it. You could probably also take in the will that's produced here. I've asked several attorneys, what if somebody walks in and says, I did my will, what would you do? Nearly all of them will tweak it some because they don't, you know, this is the way lawyers work. They want to fix something. That's their job. But this is a good solution for a lot of people. This is going to ask a question, and the question is going to be, do you want to make a gift to the Church of the Nazarene Foundation? If you answer that question yes, then you must make a designation. And you can say, I want this to go to my local church and put the name of the church in. You can put Mid-American Nazarene University in. You can put Pinecrest Camp in. You can put Alabaster Fund. Anything you want to put in there, you can put in there. You can even write Samaritan's Purse or Billy Graham Association, American Family, whatever you want to, and we'll handle that gift. But what's going to happen then is it takes the executor or personal representative's responsibility. It reduces their responsibility because if you're leaving to like five or six nonprofits, the executor's got a lot of work to do to figure out who they are. It'll come to the Church of the Nazarene Foundation. We'll move that money right out. We do this every day. So make sure that you designate your church if you want a gift to go to your church. Then live as long as you can, but know comfortably that if you do go to heaven, part of your assets are going to be a gift to your church at that point. Yes?
Well, that sounds like a big advantage to mm-hmm. specify the Church of the Nazarene Foundation, mm-hmm. and then you have your subcategories
right.
of how you would vote.
Yeah. So that's not the place where you put down money for your children, you know. That happens. That's going to have to happen through the probate. This will actually, if anybody in here from California, it'll make a revocable trust in California. It's just that that wills in the other 49 states. So yeah, it is an advantage. It does kind of simplify some things. And we've had people that they diagnosed with a bad cancer of some kind, and say, I've only got a few months. I want to make sure this is right. And they have lots of Nazarene things or lots of Christian things they want to go to. It makes the lawyer's job more simple, and it's kind of what we're designed to do. We are kind of like a community foundation for the community called the Church of the Nazarene. So this is the kind of services that you would get from a community foundation somewhere.
I found that designated beneficiaries on all of your assets that have that capability is the easiest by far.
Yeah, it really is. Some states you can do deeds. You can do what they call them, transfer on death deeds.
Yeah, you can do that here in Missouri.
Can you do that in Missouri? How about titled vehicles?
Absolutely.
So bank accounts, IRA accounts, all those kind of things.
Those, yep.
There's
anything
a reason
that you do beneficiary or transfer on death. Makes everything, because it's not, then it's outside of the trust, it's outside
right.
the
probate,
will, everything.
Yeah.
It just happens, and generally, unless you hit the $5 million mark, there's no, it marks up the value of whatever it is, mm-hmm. and that becomes a new value, and there's no tax liability.
Right, so yeah, if it's transfer on death, you still get the step up in basis on real estate and so forth, yeah. And I know this from personal experience, because about a year before my dad passed away, when it was clear that that was going to happen, we did all of the deeds, all of the bank accounts, everything. We never opened probate or had a trustee in my dad's estate. It was a pretty good sized estate. There was 5 deeds and cell phone tower and banks, a few banks worth of stuff. So it all worked that way. However, there's a reason why attorneys will tell you not to do that. Okay. So what the attorney said, we didn't do. And the attorneys will tell you that because the presumption is everybody's going to die in the proper order. So so let's say my sister and I, we walked in, we all sat there with the attorney, let's make the deeds to the property transfer on death. And then his statement is, you realize that if one of you dies the day before your dad dies, the other one gets all of the real estate and not the other one's children, because there's, in a will or a trust, you can designate if this, then this, if this, then this, if this, then this. And if you're standing there with a bank teller saying, I want to change the beneficiary on my certificate of deposit, they're not going to be able to write all those things out in all those different ways. So there is some risk if people die in the wrong order, that part of the family gets cut out. There's also some risk, let's say you have a $100,000 certificate deposit and you have 4 kids and you make them the beneficiary on this. That's like having a joint bank account. It's not like having 4 $25,000 new CDs or 4 beneficiaries of $25,000. So you can create a scenario where the kids have a little foot race to the bank, and the first one that gets there withdraws the whole $100,000 if they want to. So there are some dangers with that. Certainly not bad. You can take away one of the dangers often when people leaving some to the church. So if you've already done your will and so forth, and you say, "Oh, I wish I would remember to do the will," then I would say, "Well, go to a life insurance policy, go to an IRA account, go to a certificate of deposit, make that charitable beneficiary." You can use the foundation for that, but you really don't need it. See, those are pretty easy. You could, except for the IRA one. You may want to use the, you may want to leave the IRA one to the foundation and designate your local church. But you can do that. When you use the tool that I gave you on this little card right here, if you told it, it's going to ask where your assets are. If you said, I have a retirement account at Fidelity and I have a Bank of America savings account, it's going to ask you if you want to change the beneficiary on any of those. And it actually goes to Fidelity and Bank of America and pulls the beneficiary designation form and gives it to you, so that if you want to do that around your will or around your trust, you can do it. Yeah,
so
sounds like Amanda's been through it.
Yeah, so, IRAs,
mm-hmm.
right? If you say set the church as the
beneficiary,
then is the church liable for the tax?
That's an awesome question. So if I were your kid and you had a $100,000 house, $100,000 cash, or $100,000 IRA, which one do I want to inherit?
House and the cash.
Cash first. Okay, cash is usually the right answer there. Second thing I'd like to inherit is the house. Because you do get the step up in basis. There's not going to be capital gains if you sell that. The worst thing to inherit is the inherited IRA, because you're inheriting the responsibility for the taxes. If you want to make the most tax effective gift to the church, it's the IRA, because the church can accept the IRA and cash it with no tax penalty whatsoever. Pardon me?
I'm saying there's a lot of people that are afraid to do that, and I don't think they need to be afraid, because you can split it. Let's say the IRA is, there's some people that have $300,000 in an IRA, mm-hmm. and they've got three kids and they want them to get it, you know, like you just said, and it's, but they have a charitable intent and they're afraid that, you know, they're nixing their kids out of a gift. But they're really putting that 10-year tax liability on them. They got 10 years
right.
to pay the taxes on it.
Yeah, even if they're not old enough to withdraw without penalty. Yeah.
You split that IRA into a $200,000 IRA with the same investments as a $100,000. You can leave the $100,000 one to the church. And the kids, if you're afraid of giving the church that whole $300,000, mm-hmm. you can split an IRA and give them the charity, the portion that you want. And the kids would still inherit the tax liability of it.
Right.
You know, the church gets their $100,000 tax-free.
And if you happen to be unfortunate enough to inherit a really large 10-year limited inherited IRA, we can work with you a little bit on a remainder trust that can at least stretch that well past the 10 years, but that has to happen with the beneficiary. And I might introduce Roger Alexander to you. What I'm doing with planned giving for the denomination, Roger does for Mid-American Nazarene University, and what I've been doing here for 10 years, Roger's been doing for like 40 years. So he's a great resource. We work together on things all the time. It's great. Those IRAs, they can be a little complicated on the beneficiary side of things. So you might want to use the foundation or Mid-America or somebody for that process rather than putting that all on your local church.
That's probably including generically KEO plans and SEPs. And
yeah.
Each one, I suspect, has a little different effects and outcome implications.
Right, but I don't know that any of them. None of those would pass. I'm not an attorney, I'm a preacher, but none of those, from my understanding, would pass any tax liability onto the church. That's all going to get washed out when it happens there, except for one, and that's U.S. savings bonds. U.S. savings bond is not a great thing to leave to the church, because the estate's going to be responsible for the tax, and the church is going to get all the money. That's the worst scenario out there. You don't want to make that one happen. But savings bonds aren't as common as they used to be. I'm going to do a workshop later today on non-cash assets. So about 93% of what America owns is not cash. When we ask for an offering in the church, we typically say, hey, would you give us cash? So let's open that thinking up to giving other things. And so we handle gifts of stocks, mutual funds, and bonds. 2022 wasn't the best year for that, because if your stock's worth less than what you paid for it, sell it and take the loss. But in most years, the stock's worth more than what you paid for it, and you're going to have a capital gain. Or at best and at worst, short-term capital gains or short-term gains. If you give stock to the church or use the foundation and use our brokerage account, which we handle for churches all the time, you are saving tax money. If you happen to have a retirement account, an IRA, and you happen to be 72 years old, the government congratulates you on your birthday by saying, and now you must take money out and pay tax. If you don't, we're going to give you a penalty, and that is a stiff penalty. You want to stay out of that one. Then you would be eligible for a qualified charitable distribution, where the money comes straight out of your IRA and goes straight to the church, and there's no tax liability on it. That's a gift we can't help you with. Mid-American can help you, and we can give you instructions on how to do that directly to your church, but there's a few complicated laws in there that does not let our kind of nonprofit actually do that. But we can certainly help you with regular stocks, bonds, mutual funds, real estate. I'm amazed when churches say to their people, you know, you can give real estate if you want to. How many times people out there say, I have a lot in some other state and I didn't know what to do with it. I just been paying the tax. Well, I would love to give that, you know, get rid of that. And how people will give real estate away for the convenience of it, just because it's they don't want to handle the whole process of finding the realtor and everything. In this part of the world, churches definitely need to be talking to the farmers in their church about gifts of agricultural product. We handle several hundred thousand dollars worth of agricultural product annually, and I'm not sure we have ever handled one in Missouri. We do it in Nebraska, Dakotas, and Kansas, and Oklahoma, and other places, but Missouri farmers have not caught that you do have it in your local church that does it. Yeah, so what happens is you have your cost of production in your soybeans and corn and so forth, and if you sell it, you're going to pay income tax on the difference there. If you donate the grain, you have no income on your farm, but you still have the expenses. It's just about as much double dipping as you can get to into the IRS's pockets, which accomplishes their goals. As much as possible for the family, as much as possible for the church, as little as possible to the IRS. That's principles that are guiding us on what we want to have happen here. We do handle gifts of gold, silver, coins, collections. We don't want to run your yard sale. But if you have good stuff, and we've handled some really nice pieces of artwork into the tens of thousands of dollars, and the gold bullion, people tend to collect that. And it's not, you know, you don't just walk into the bank and say, here's gold. So you have to find a way to sell that.
In your office, uh-huh, many moons ago,
yeah,
worked on a gift of an airplane. I
mean, yep.
Vehicles are significant, farm implements,
right,
et cetera. Anything with a title?
Yeah.
Mark would be happy to chat with you.
And the farm implements is really a significant one because that's ordinary income when you sell it. One of the reasons that farmers have rows of old tractors and equipment is because they don't want to pay tax to sell it. So they'd rather see it rust away. And they can give it away without any taxes. And so it's been depreciated. Yeah, absolutely true. And then insurance policies. A lot of people get insurance policies because they want some money for their children to be raised with, and now their children are 65, retired, and doing well, and they still have that insurance policy. That's a great policy to donate. You can either donate the policy or make your local church or the foundation beneficiary of the policy, or you can donate the policy and then continue to make the payments through the nonprofit, and those become charitable deductions when you're making your interest payment or your insurance payment. We've got a couple complicated ones here that we're not going to spend a lot of time on, but if you're at all familiar in the world of charitable remainder trust, there's like 40 different kinds of these. The most common one is the unit trust, and this typically happens when somebody has an income-producing assets that is highly depreciated or it's going to have a lot of capital gains to it, but a person doesn't really want to give up the income. And I can give you a kind of a cool example or two of this. We had an individual with a piece of real estate they hadn't seen in years worth about $250,000. His taxes, I think, were in the $2,500 range, and his income on it was about $6,000 or $7,000. So he had $250,000 piece of real estate, inherited it 40 years ago. Cost basis was really low, $250,000, clearing $4,000 or so. He came to us and he said, all I do with this money is go on a work and witness trip. That's the only thing I want to do. I want enough money to go on a work and witness trip a year. I'd be happy to give the piece of real estate away. When he gave it away, but he didn't want to sell it, because if he sells it, he's got 23% going to the IRS. And that's a chunk of money. You're talking $60,000, $70,000 straight out the door to the IRS just by selling that piece of real estate. So he donated the piece of real estate into a trust that we created. We sold it with no capital gains tax. Sold the property, put it on a 5% trust, and it happened about 8 or 9 years ago, so it hit some really good years in there. He gets about $12,000 a year. No taxes. His income more than doubled off of the asset, and no capital gains tax, and he's got $12,000 a year now to go on his work and witness trip. That can work really well with rental properties, rental houses, because people in your church, they have rental houses, but they get tired of collecting rent and fixing pipes when they're up in their 70s somewhere, you know, and so that's not much fun anymore. And it's hard to sell those things and get out of the tax. But we can certainly help somebody in your church do an irrevocable gift that's guaranteed to come to your church at the end of it. Gift annuities are really popular when interest is low, as it has been this year. They're not going to be as much fun. But if you're 70, 80, 90 years old, people in your church, rather than making a gift at the end of their life, can make that gift now and get a guaranteed return on their gift for the remainder of their life. And as you can see, if you're young like me, it's not any better than the money market right now. But if you got enough years under your belt, a gift annuity can be very beneficial to somebody, especially if they're not, these are not rich people's kind of gifts. These are people that have got a little bit of money and expecting to get more out of the bank than they thought. So we do a gift annuity for $10,000 or $20,000, and it really bumps their income up. Roger?
This is a way for people who are older in your congregation, or your family, or your neighbors. And some of them will say, well, I've already done my will, and I've got my trust all set up, but I never thought about giving the church anything. You kind of brought up a point, Pastor. And working with Mark, they can make a $10,000. We typically, $10,000 or more is, mm-hmm. is anything less than $10,000, they probably ought to keep and just give somehow in the offering plate over time. But if they want to make a gift to your church, they can set this aside and get paid on their birthday. This payment mm-hmm. could come on their birthday, and they always give them, they know they're going to get one gift. And then whatever's left at their passing can go to your church.
Right.
And so it's a way for people not have to spend money with a lawyer mm-hmm. or time or grief. They could do $10,000, $20,000 here and really benefit themselves and make a charitable gift to ministry.
And the return to the church is really fast after they go to heaven, so it doesn't have to go through probate. It has nothing to do. It's non-probatable in that respect, like the transfer on deaths are. So, go ahead.
The way this works is, say I gave $20,000, and mm-hmm. then annually I get whatever that is, 4.5% of that back.
Yeah.
As the gift.
Okay. Yeah, or monthly or quarterly, however you want to set it up.
But you also get probably a 30-40%, depending on your age. You get about a 40% income tax deduction on that
right.
$20,000. So there's $8,000 of income tax deduction. And that 5% you get during your lifetime, to your life expectancy, there's a lot, it gets taxed favorably. So if
yeah.
you get $500 a year on a $10,000 gift, you may only have to pay taxes on $150 of that.
Right.
And the other $350 gets
is return of principal. Yep.
If there's no tax on it. So you get $500, you only pay taxes on $100.50.
So these work well when all the circumstances come together right, mm-hmm. but for the church's sake, you'll have the money within 2 weeks after they pass away, after somebody tells us we pass away. That's one of the problems. They have to tell us that they passed away. But this money comes fast to the church. It's irrevocable. It's not going away. For the cases where the money is going to be consumed by Medicaid, you need to be at least several years ahead. I've heard 10 years back here. Most typically, we say 5 years in advance. So somebody can't call us up the day before they go to the nursing home and say, hey, I got to give it all away. They're going to take it because you'll actually cause the donor to live under a bridge for a few years, and we don't want that. So we help people stay out of those situations. But if that's a long time out, they make this gift, and they're happy to realize that the money's gone. It's never coming back to them. It can be a really good gift.
You can do that with the stock or cash. I mean, there's other assets, but the primary ones are cash or a mutual fund or a stock.
Right. Yeah, when it goes in a stock, you get the charitable deduction, and you don't have the capital gains, so it's a win-win. We do endowments for local churches. I'm going to check the time here, because I'm supposed to be done by 12:15. Not careful, it'll be 4 o'clock. I'll still be talking, it'll be 4 o'clock. So we handle endowments for local churches. Endowments, typically people think, well, this has to be huge, but it really doesn't have to be that huge. And it can come through an estate gift at the end of life. But endowments haven't been a Nazarene thing. If you're pastoring in a church that's got an old Presbyterian church in it, it's probably got an endowment. And so let's say that you really like Pinecrest and you want to send your kids there to the camp. How much does it cost to send a kid to camp?
Uh,
225 if you pre-register this year.
225. So so you could pretty much say that a $10,000 endowment is going to cover at least one, maybe two children every year. So if somebody has a real passion for this and they want their church to be able to give scholarships, they could give us $10,000. We're probably going to give them about $350 to $400 back every year in an endowment. And that's appealing to baby boomers who are the ones dying now because they like giving gifts to their church, but they're afraid their church will spend it all right away. How many times in my life, I had a guy one time say, my church is $1 million in debt, I'd love to just pay it off for him. But if I pay it off for him, they'll just go into debt again. I don't want that. Can I give them $1 million and they have to promise they'll not go into debt for 20 years? So I don't think we have anything that works like that.
I want them to match whatever's given.
Yeah.
To be able to spend it.
Yeah.
You know, if I gave the church $500,000 instead of just giving you a whole bunch of money all at once and,
right.
and causing the church to split in three ways, I want them to have to match whatever they
yeah.
spend. Or they could spend the interest on it mm-hmm. at any given moment. That would be my.
So, on those kind of creative things, we can be the guardian, I guess I would say, or the doorkeeper on those kind of things. Because if you leave your money into an endowment and your local church says, yeah, but we really need it, we really, really need it all right now, then we're going to say, I'm sorry, but the donor intent was that you only get the 3% a year, or you get the interest off of it, or whatever, however you want to set it up. But you should, with as small as a $10,000 gift, be able to, our intent is to grow it through the years, so the buying power stays the same. You should be able to give a camp scholarship to Pinecrest till Jesus comes back. That's a really cool concept. So I think we have time for fun stories, don't we? This one's a different district, so I can tell this story. I changed the names and the places, you know. So to protect the generous, but we had a small church that just loved the Lord and was doing what a church should do. They loved a mom and her little children after a divorce. So this lady wandered in, she had her children, and she was just distraught, and the church just put their arms around her and loved this lady. Well, Grandma noticed this, and Grandma was from a Presbyterian church. So Grandma calls the pastor and says, I'd like to contribute to your endowment. He said, endowment? What's that? We're a Nazarene church. We don't have an endowment. Wait a minute, let me call a foundation. So we got involved, and we went down and met with everybody, and she said, well, could I start an endowment for you then? Because I just really appreciate what you did for my grandkids and my daughter. And she said, well, I would do that. I would like to give $250,000 to start an endowment for your church. And her rest of her family was there, and her son said, Mom, that's awesome. I'll match it. So he matched it. $500,000 comes in. And that yields, you can get usually 4% or so, but it's pretty close to $25,000 a year now that church gets every year designated for ministry to single moms and children. Is that not a cool story or what? I mean, that's the way it works. That's the way we want it to work. But we can either have church-started endowments or donor-started endowments. If a church starts an endowment, they typically say, we're going to have this endowment, they do a rally and get it started, and then put all of their planned gifts into it for stay sustainable for the future. It's a good theological concept that's built on the fact that built on the scripture of seven fat cows, then seven skinny cows, or oil in your lamps, or whatever. Because once in a while, I run into preachers who say, "No, God gives it to you. You're supposed to spend it. You're not allowed to save it. That's not faithful." But it is a lot of scripture out there that says preparing for the future is not the worst thing out there. Donor advised funds. 20% of all the charitable money given away in America now is coming through a donor advised fund. Is anybody receiving donor advised funds checks in your church? So a donor advised fund is kind of like a charitable savings account. Donors use them effectively. They use them for a lot of different purposes, but the money is charitable when it goes in, or the stock, or the real estate, whatever goes in the donor advised fund is charitable. They have one receipt at the end of the year. Then when they want to do something charitable, they can say to the holder of the donor advised fund, it would be us in this case, send $1,000 to my church, send $1,000 to that college, do whatever you want to with it. Some people will put stock in every December, anticipating how much they want to give the next year. For farmers or anybody that has up and down income, you know, if you get flooded and you lose money on your farm one year, what's your tithe?
Yeah.
That's really easy to calculate, you know, because 10% of zero is still zero. But there are people with fluctuating incomes that like to use a donor-advised fund to get ahead so that their church doesn't suffer in a year that they're not actually making much money. You can bunch your deductions on this thing. Standard deductions, $24,000-some right now. If you're giving $23,000 a year to your church and that's your only deduction, you don't get any value out of your deduction. You could give $75,000 into a donor advised fund 1 year and have a nice deduction, take the standard deduction the next 2 years and you pay less taxes than other people. And so you can bunch your deductions. The only thing is you have to have 3 years worth of tithe at one time to put in there. But that can work really well. This is very popular. We have, this money is sitting there waiting for somebody to say, hey, the Lord's touched my heart, move this money out there. And this is popular enough. We have 43 or 44 million in donor advised funds right now. So this is a happening thing. It also makes it really easy for people because they've bunched up and accumulated some dollars to respond to a need immediately. If you're standing in front of your church saying, hey, we furnace blew up, we got to have $10,000, you are probably appealing to the free cash in everybody's checkbooks. If somebody's already got money in their donor advised fund, it's just like send it out, make it happen, let it go. Good. And other gifts. We already talked about the IRA gifts and the beneficiary designations. We already talked about those two because they came up. But the life estate reserve is one that we do every once in a while. Just had one finish up this last year where a person can donate their home and retain the right to live in it for the remainder of their life. They agree to pay the maintenance taxes and insurance. But they can actually donate their home. This can be used to avoid loss to Medicaid if it's done advanced far enough, you know, way out there in advance. Yeah. So you can't do this and right before you go to the nursing home.
No, but that's so I, you know.
Yeah. The deed's transferred. It's in the name of the. It'd be in the name of the foundation if we did it, and they don't go back on that if as long as you're ahead of the waiting period there. They can't go back on it. It was a gift, and the taxes. You already got your charitable deduction for the gift, and it's a done deal. You don't own the home anymore. You just have to be really, really sure that's where you want to wind her up, because you can't transfer that or make something else happen. You can donate. Yeah. The asset's gone. You can donate the remaining period of your life. So let's say you do a life estate reserve, give your house away, live in it for 10 years, and you think, yeah, I'd really rather live in Florida. And you want to get out of the house, you can actually get a charitable deduction for however many years you were likely to have lived in it. If you want to give that away. That's it. I think we did all right. Didn't we? I'm ready for questions. Yeah, it's only 9 after. Any questions about any of these things? We're available in here. Take those little cards, take them and give them to your church, run that in the bulletin, say if you don't have a will, do it. Tell them to click yes on I want to make a gift to the Church of the Nazarene Foundation and then write the name of your church in. This is brand new service. We opened it up on September, but we didn't really tell anybody about it till about February. We already have 43 wills, and if you count the primary, secondary, and tertiary gift level, it's like $7 million that could potentially come into Nazarene churches through this. And so it's a brand new service. We hope you take advantage of it. All right. Great. Thanks, everybody.
Is that a 50-state program?
All 50 states. It'll do a revocable trust in California.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's got like a $60,000 estate limit or something. If you go over $60,000, probate kicks in crazy.
Not for anything. No. This is... there's no limit on what size your estate is. You don't know what your estate's going to be when you go to heaven.
Yeah, I know, but in California they used to have a really low limit before, a trust really, really, really made sense.
You would have to pretend, you'd have to go on the site and pretend you're from California to find out.
Yeah.
And if you go on and pretend that you're George and Martha Washington, you'll find out that I've already been there.